Let the spirit of intercessory prayer be great upon us all, O Lord. Let the spirit of worship be great within us, the unction to worship you in spirit and in truth, the unction to be the true worshipers of God. And, O Lord, we pray again that the endowment of power through the unction would be manifest in our lives to confirm the word that you would speak through us. Thank you for all of these wondrous provisions, and may we continue on in the intimate communion that you've given us license and liberty to. Thank you, Lord. Glory to your holy name. Hallelujah and amen.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us on the line Dr. Carson Holloway. We're going to be talking about his book, All Shook Up, Music, Passion, and Politics. Now, Dr. Holloway actually wrote the basis of this book was his doctoral thesis in political science, and he actually teaches political science at the present time. But he has contributed tremendously to our understanding of the part that music plays in society. Now, I don't think the average individual who turns on television is really conscious of the impact that music has on him. The background music in so many of our television programs, sometimes it's to perhaps it'll have an exhilarating impact on you, and you'll feel good. Other times they want to frighten you. It's going to be a Stephen King mystery, and there'll be something sort of ominous in the music. But it's in the background, and you don't recognize what that music is doing to you. But it's certainly guiding your response to what you're seeing. Well, of course, Dr. Holloway gives us a great deal about the history of music. It's been said there's nothing new under the sun. And if you go back and you read what Plato and Aristotle wrote, they understood the influence of music on society. Dr. Holloway, thank you so very much for being with us this late at night.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you just go ahead and start back at the very beginning of your as your book starts with the writings of Plato and Aristotle and their opinion of music and its impact on society.
Sure. Their opinion's rather striking to us because, as you indicated, we don't think very much about this question, but they gave a good deal of sustained attention to it in their writings like Plato's Republic and Aristotle's Politics. And surprisingly to us, perhaps, they treat music as if it's the most important part of education, and by education they mean character formation of the young. And they don't mince any words in saying that. I think Socrates in Plato's Republic says it's the most sovereign element in the rearing of the young. It is, they think, so powerful because music is, and this is kind of a cliche, I suppose, but not the less true for that, it's the language of the passions. It can speak to the passions. Music, they say, imitates the passions. And at the same time, it can evoke or move the passions of the listener. And by music, they mean, and this might even be more surprising to the listener, the modern listener, Plato and Aristotle mean by music, music in the strict sense, say music, musical rhythm and harmony and melody and not just words. They certainly don't deny the importance of poetry or literature in the formation of character. But again, they think melody can speak to the passions and that therefore can form character. And they were, I think, concerned about a kind of music that would unduly stimulate the passions, we might say. Ultimately, what they wanted from their musical education was the formation of a character that was characterized by moderation. Moderation is good. Moderation of the passions is good because it allows reason to guide the passions, and that's what they thought was how we would describe a healthy human soul, that reason rules over the passions. So music had a part to play in providing that kind of rearing. It could speak to the passions but kind of charm them and calm them and provide them with standards of beauty in light of which people could act morally.
Hold that just thought for just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Carson Holloway, and this is talking about music. And I certainly was known that music had an impact upon society, music had an impact upon the soul. And here you find Plato and Aristotle writing about this and talking about how the rhythm, the harmony, of the music of the soul as a whole certainly could have a profound impact on really what was taking place in society. And yet, don't you think that much of what they wrote about has been long since forgotten?
It seems like we have forgotten it. We don't see, typically, any kind of connection between music, rather, and character, and politics. And it's something that was a preoccupation of Plato and Aristotle's. They, in fact, claimed that the character of a whole society can be determined by the music to which it listens, and especially the music to which the young listen. Socrates doesn't hesitate to say in Plato's Republic that never are the ways of music changed without the greatest political laws being changed. And he says the guardians of the best regime will take care lest an alien and novel form of music come in. And ultimately, again, their concern is moderation. They point out very wisely, I think, that there's a connection between immoderation and injustice on the one hand and moderation and justice on the other. Immoderate people whose desires are out of control, are ultimately led by those unruly desires to do harm to others around them in order to gratify the desires, because it's always easier to get things without working by, you know, defrauding other people or just getting into conflicts with them generally because everybody wants more than everybody can have. And again, that can be the result of two things on their account. It could be the result of simply neglecting the proper music education, not having any musical education at all. Because, again, they think a healthy rearing of the young human being is one that would calm the passions. But, you know, they think on their own the passions are the strongest part of the human being or of the human soul. You know, the best part is not the most powerful, and that's why it needs the assistance of this musical education in what's beautiful and noble. So that would be one way in which you could get a bad character, is by simply neglecting music. What you could also do, which would probably be even worse, is to get reared in the wrong kind of music, or in music that doesn't aim to calm the passions and give reason a chance, but instead is hostile to reason because it's excessively passionate. And they were very careful in their writings to say this is not the kind of music that we would want the young of the best city to hear. And arguably, that's exactly the kind of music that we've got now.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. All right, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Dr. Carson Holloway. And, of course, one of the things I'm reading from page 29, he comments, rhythm and harmony, Socrates argued, begin to shape a person's soul before he's able to grasp reasonable speech. They really felt that music could shape the soul, and they were talking about this 2,350 or more years ago, and yet we've forgotten that today.
Yeah, we have it. You know, that passage makes another important point that I think explains music's power. The ancients also thought, and again, I think if we reflected on our own experience, it would bear this out, that the human soul was very malleable or formable when it's young, right? In other words, young people are impressionable, and that's part of music's power. I mean, it naturally is appealing to any human being, but especially to the young, and the young are apt to take on the impression of whatever kind of art and stories and music that they're exposed to. And since, as that passage indicates, Socrates says music can speak to the human soul before it's even capable of rational speech, we're talking about little children who have musical experiences that already begin to form their passions and therefore to shape their character. So it's a very powerful tool that we don't even think about very much, and consequently I think most parents don't exercise any kind of guardianship over their children with regard to music, or at least not a serious enough one, on Plato and Aristotle's understanding. Yeah.
And of course, you know, we're told, oh, well, you know, certainly your parents didn't like that sort of music you had, so we expect you to disagree with the music that your child is listening to. And they'll probably disagree with the music they're children are listening to, but there's been a progressive degeneration of music during my lifetime from what it was back in the 1940s and 50s, the music of the great bands to the Michael Jackson MTV, loud, boisterous music with the festivals where people almost go into a frenzy there at these rock festivals.
Yeah, you know, it's not really a valid defense, I don't think, of our popular music culture to merely appeal to the fact that it's a common generational experience for parents to dislike their kids' music, because as it doesn't, I mean, it really doesn't prove anything, does it? As you point out, it's certainly possible that music has just been degenerating for several generations, and that every generation that complains actually has something to complain about. Because, I mean, and it seems to me more or less obvious that if you look at the history of popular music, it's become more and more characterized by frenzied passion and less characterized by any kind of subtlety or grace or restraint. Certainly, I mean, if you compare, because you were talking about a minute ago, when you talked about the music of the 40s, you were talking about popular music, not any kind of art music, right? That was a lot more sophisticated and graceful and restrained than what we've got now. And if Plato and Aristotle are right, that can only have a serious impact on the young people who listen to it so intently, and therefore can only have an impact on our culture that will be detrimental.
Amen to that. Well, I vote for Lawrence Welk and doing away with most of what we have today. Well, then, of course, you follow the history of music on, and, of course, we get to a time when John Locke, this is in the 1600s, and John Locke was one of the great philosophers upon whom much of the American experiment rests, his philosophy of a logical approach, nature's God, nature's law, all men being certainly answerable to God and to the rights of life, liberty, and property. These were Lockean ideas, but what was your thought about Locke and music?
Well, there's a lot to be praised in Locke, and he's very sensible on many things, but where I would criticize him, since, as is obvious by now, I'm coming from Plato and Aristotle's standpoint, the defect in Locke, I think, is that he doesn't take music seriously as a political and cultural and moral force. I think part of the reason he doesn't is because he's now offering a kind of political thought that's not as interested as Plato and Aristotle were in forming the character or forming the soul. It's more of an approach to politics that's concerned with protecting property and protecting public order so that people can have prosperity from a growing economy. And all of those things are important, but he limits his interest to those things, whereas Plato and Aristotle were concerned with those as well as higher things. And since music becomes politically important in the thought of the ancients insofar as it can form character, if you're no longer really interested in forming character anymore, like Locke wasn't, then you're not going to be interested in music. And his approach, and generally the whole modern approach, is to no longer try through politics and education to discipline the passions through a moral education that would include music, but rather just free the passions, free everybody to pursue his or her own self-interest, and then cleverly design institutions that will restrain that pursuit of self-interest. Like in politics, for example, separation of powers, where you use self-interest to check self-interest, or in economics, the marketplace, different competing institutions restrain each other and achieve the common good. But there's no concern there with, on an individual level, one by one, forming beautiful souls, and so music ceases to be very important. And I think that whole modern approach has been very influential and has formed most developed modern societies, and I think that's why it's so hard for us as members of those societies to take seriously the idea that music could be of political importance.
Well, of course, there's one side is the politics. The other, of course, is the spiritual. Mm-hmm. And when you try to divorce the two, you start getting into trouble, and you get sort of a schizophrenia like we have today. Well, let's go forward then to Rousseau, because Rousseau comes along early 1700s?
Mid and late, yeah.
Okay, fine. And so Rousseau has some strong views on music as well, doesn't he?
He does. He's sort of the first one that I point out, the first political philosopher, to try to recover the importance of music in political philosophy. In that sense, he tries to hark back to the ancients, Plato and Aristotle, and he's really a critic of modern society. I would say he's a harsh critic of what he would call modern bourgeois society, and basically the kind of society we live in that's dominated by self-interest and the pursuit of self-interest. And he wanted to restore a kind of politics that was about citizenship or, radical commitment to the political community, patriotism, love of the fatherland, willingness to sacrifice. And in order to to foster that kind of commitment, he returned to a concern with music. Like the ancients, he thought that music had this power to speak to the soul, and he wanted to use it to form a certain kind of character. On the other hand, he's different from Plato and Aristotle, because he no longer believed in reason, remember, or in reason's ability to say anything very worthwhile about the difference between right and wrong or about moral principles. And remember I said earlier, Plato and Aristotle wanted to use music to calm the passions, to foster reason. I think Rousseau wants to use music to agitate the passions, to create a kind of passionate commitment to a certain understanding of patriotic commitment to the community. But from a certain standpoint, that's, you know, even though it's superficially in line with the ancients because they wanted to use music for the sake of virtue, but it's different from the ancients because he wants a kind of passionate virtue rather than a virtue that controls the passions.
Well, of course, Rousseau was really sort of a revolutionary. He wanted to change society, didn't he?
He wanted to radically change it. To the extent that he, you know, hoped, apparently, that it might be possible to restore a more virtuous kind of politics. Now, it gets complicated because you're not sure exactly to what extent you can hold him accountable for, like, the French Revolution and those revolutionary theorists who were very destructive and bloodthirsty. But he was certainly no fan of the existing society, and perhaps it would be fair to say that he thought it was so corrupt that he wasn't afraid to preach very powerfully the need to change it, and maybe to that extent created or fed some very revolutionary passions in other people.
And of course, certainly, would it be fair to say that Rousseau sort of foreshadowed the coming of the French Revolution?
I think so. Again, he might not have approved of it in every manifestation, but the people who were movers and shakers in the French Revolution, I think, thought of themselves as being informed by Rousseau's thought, especially in their concern with equality and freedom, and in their understanding of, you know, the new society's right to remake everything.
And then, of course, you have your French Revolution, and within a dozen years, well, you're back, and you have an emperor, and his name is Napoleon. So that seems to be the way things go. Well, then, of course, we fast forward to a man named Nietzsche, and I think that you bring out some very important parts about Nietzsche, because certainly Nietzsche, man, and Superman, certainly this idea of ultra-nationalism, this certainly foreshadowed the regime of Adolf Hitler, didn't it?
It does, I think, in a way, although, again, I wouldn't, without being very careful, blame Nietzsche for Hitler, although I think he does bear some responsibility. In other words, kind of like with Rousseau, I think if Nietzsche had been on the scene with Hitler, he might have disapproved, but there's still something in his principles that do foreshadow, as you so well put it, the coming of Nazism. He's like Rousseau, but even more radical. I think by the time you get to Nietzsche in Western political theory, you've got someone who's very clearly and completely rejecting reason and suggesting that reason has nothing to say to human beings about justice versus injustice. At the same time, he's preoccupied with nobility or greatness, and disgusted, like Rousseau, with what he views as the kind of boring, low, soullessness, the kind of commercial, self-interested society that came to dominate Europe. And so, like Rousseau, and like the ancients, he was also powerfully moved by music, and especially Wagner's music. And he thought that in that music he saw the possibility of reconstituting a nobler society, but the way he understood nobility was problematic because it was divorced from reason.
Okay, well, we're going to be back here in just a few moments with our special guest this evening. And, of course, when you begin to get into Nazism, you find an obsession with Wagner's music. I remember I was a young military officer going to Lake Chiemsee in Bavaria, and sitting in the grotto where Hitler sat by hours for hours listening to the music of Wagner. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Carson Holloway, talking about his book All Shook Up: Music, Passion, and Politics, a very important book to understand what's happening to America today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Carson Holloway, his book, All Shook Up, Music, Passion, and Politics. And so we were talking about the influence of Wagner and Wagner's music on Hitler, on the Nazi movement. Would you like to sort of develop that or extrapolate on that?
Sure. And let me tell you a little bit, too, about Nietzsche. I think, you know, we were talking before the break about the extent to which Nietzsche could be blamed for Nazism, and I think the way in which he could be held accountable for at least preparing the ground is, as I was saying, he wanted to use music to foster a new kind of nobility, to get people worked up to a passionate commitment to some kind of way of life. The problem, of course, is he no longer believes that reason can tell us anything about justice and injustice and what's noble and what's base. So if you're going to pursue a kind of greatness or glory or nobility and divorce it from reason, you're going to be in danger of embracing an understanding of greatness that might really just turn out to be a kind of barbaric cruelty that's self-aggrandizing, or as it turned out to be in the actual case, hyper-nationalistic, you know, a nobility that manifests itself, I should say a perverted nobility, right, that manifests itself as such single-minded commitment to your own country's glory and dominion that you're utterly indifferent to the rights of other human beings and what's injustice owed to them. And so it can fairly be said that Nietzsche bears some responsibility for the emergence of Nazism, and it can be said, I think, that he loved Wagner's music and that Wagner's music would be, on Plato's principles, bad for the political community because it's primarily a music, at least as Nietzsche understood it, of passion, of ecstatic or extreme passion. When Nietzsche described the effect of Wagner's music on him to friends in his letters, he said it gives me it's intoxicating. It gives me a sense of being carried away. Everything he says about Wagner's music, at least during the period when he liked it, because he later had a falling out, but during that period when he liked it, he described it as the kind of music that extinguishes reason and pumps up the passions. And again, whether or not Wagner would have approved of the Nazis, I don't know, but the Nazis were certainly able to make use of his music in just the kind of way that one might be able to predict it could be used unhealthily, to just charm people into a kind of mindless devotion to a project that, if they weren't charmed by music, couldn't withstand any rational scrutiny at all. Because, you know, it doesn't take much thought, I don't think, to reason your way to the conclusion that you don't have the right to exterminate other people or conquer them just for the sake of your own nation's glory. But in some sense, people can be whipped into a passionate frenzy by many kinds of rhetorical devices, but especially by music. And that's the danger that we have to be mindful of.
And I think really it's amazing as you go back and you read of the Nazi period, and by the time Adolf Hitler had his invasion of, first of all, Alsace-Lorraine, and then, of course, of the Austria, and they held a plebiscite, an election, he got, I don't know, 95% or 98% of the vote. I mean, the German people were wildly ecstatic. They were solidly behind him. But what part did music play in mobilizing the German people behind the Nazi experiment in social justice?
Yeah, you can think of the maybe newsreel footage that you've seen or people have seen of the Nuremberg rallies and things like this. And the Nazis were masters of public ceremony and used all the kinds of public artistic devices, including music, that might be able to mesmerize people by
hold
their
that, hold
vision.
That, hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Carson Holloway. We've been talking about Wagner's music and how Wagner's music could inflame the passions and, of course, was used to unify the German people behind Adolf Hitler. There's something very intoxicating, I think was the word that Nietzsche had used in reference to Wagner, and how you could intoxicate the entire nation behind this idea of nationalism, conquering the fatherland, the nobility of the German cause. And Adolf Hitler used Wagner, I think, to pursue that goal. Would that be a fair statement?
I think so, and this is a real danger that the ancients were aware of. As earlier I remarked upon their positive hopes for how music could be used for the good, but they're very realistic and aware of its possible abuse. I think late in Plato's Republic in Book 10, Socrates says, you know, the thing about the poets is, and he meant this term broadly to include musicians, the danger about them is they use music to make speeches seem good that aren't really good. That, I think, it would be what we would say that the Nazis were able to do. They used music to, as I was saying, mesmerize the populace and make them give a kind of passionate and therefore unthinking commitment to a goal that was manifestly unjust.
Well, I think that the problem we have is that I don't think the average citizen, the average American today, has any idea how we're being manipulated with music and motion pictures, how we're being manipulated with music in television, how we're being manipulated with music constantly. We see the use of this, certainly in the military, the marching band, the music, the beat, the rhythm, everybody moving in unison. But what about with our young people and the rock concerts and the young people, the children today who walk around with a Walkman, and that's their whole world is simply the music. They seem to be submerged in music today. What impact is that having on the youth of America, on our nation as a whole?
Well, I think it fosters a kind of slavery, not just a slavery to a certain kind of music, which is probably not an unfair way to put it when, as you point out rightly, a lot of young people seem to be almost addicted to a certain kind of music. They have to listen to it so much. But more profound than that is kind of slavery to the passions. This is a great paradox, and maybe the most fundamental point that we don't understand as well as we should. We tend to think of freedom as freedom to do whatever you feel like doing, or freedom to pursue your passions. The ancients, Plato and Aristotle, have said, if you're ruled in your soul by your passions, that's a form of slavery. It's slavery because the passions aren't the best part of the human soul, reason is. And it's also slavery because, when you think about it, who is more easily manipulable than a person who is dominated by his or her passions? All you have to do is figure out what buttons to push, and you can make them do what you want. And so I think one problem of the kind of music young people listen to, much of it, which is, I think, an education in just passionate affirmation without a kind of nod to reason, is that it makes them manipulable. And especially the forms of music that are designed to agitate their passions just for the sake of the commercial success of the artist, but then to everything else that's an appeal to passion, whether it be in politics or advertising or various kinds of educational fads, the most serious consequence of it is that if you rear a generation of people who are dominated by their passions, they're not really fit for democratic citizenship, and that's the real problem we would face.
Well, I certainly agree, and I think that we can't divorce music from political science, but of course we have. In fact, other than yourself, there are very, very few people out there who really go into the background, the history of this, and yet, of course, it's something that every American should know and understand. And I think the point that you make, and of course it was made by Aristotle and Plato, is that music can move the soul. And of course this is one of my concerns, is what is happening in the Christian church today? I mean, the Christian church, which once had the great hymns of the past, were inspiring and drawing us close to God, and suddenly we see this replaced with a raucous rock music that would make even the Beatles certainly blush.
Yeah, and I think that on Plato and Aristotle's principles, that's something to be concerned about. They talk about music as if the musical styles themselves have a certain ethical content. And so I think they would call into question whether you can really preach a message of nobility or holiness by using music that appeals to the passions. Ultimately, what you need to live an upright life is discipline over the passions and not mere, temporary enthusiasms that you can stir up through music. So I think they would wonder whether that's the right approach.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a few moments. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. We'd like to get your thoughts, your input on this subject that we're talking about this evening, music and its impact on the soul, its impact on society. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Carson Holloway, and we're talking about his book, All Shook Up. It's published by Spence Publishers. How can people get copies of your book?
The best way to get the book is to go directly to Spence Publishing and mention this program and that you heard about the book there and get, I believe, a 40% discount, which is pretty sizable. And you can go through their website, which is www.spencepublishing.com. So it's Spence Publishing, like it's one word, .com. They also have a toll-free number, which is 1-888-SPEN-PUB, so 1-888-SPENPUB.
Well, certainly Spence Publishers has some of the best books. We always enjoy interviewing their authors because they're quality books. They're written by people who've done a lot of thought and analysis. And, you know, they're not these sort of superficial the books, but they really get very deep into the philosophical discussion. And, of course, without philosophy, you can't understand what's going on today. We have too many people who want to have sort of a knee-jerk reaction to what's going on in society without realizing, of course, there are always forces at work behind what's going on today. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment on this subject, I think it's a vitally important one. Now, of course, you mentioned that Alan Bloom, in his book, was The Closing of the American Mind.
That's right.
Had actually talked about the impact of society, one of the impact of music on society, and that he was one of the very, very few people in academics who was recognizing the impact of music on modern society.
Yeah, that was a very controversial and important book, I think, and one, it shows you how important music is, I think, to people that even though only about, I think, 11 pages of that book deal with music, that stirred the most discussion among people who didn't like the book, I think precisely because Bloom did, unlike most people, take music seriously because of its serious consequences. And in his case, he wasn't concerned so much with the moral consequences, which is a little bit more what I'm concerned with, but he was concerned with the consequences for higher education. But there's an overlap between the two concerns. What he observed, and I think he was largely right, was that a kind of very popular rock music to which the young are exposed a great deal and which they love is kind of a condemnation of reason and a celebration of unrestrained passion. And Bloom's concern ultimately is that's no basis on which to build a liberal education. People who are going to be liberally educated or to pursue knowledge for its own sake have to have a certain respect for reason, and they're not getting it. Ideally, he says, you would have a kind of music that introduces people to the good, the true, and the beautiful.
Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, our guest this evening, Dr. Carson Holloway, and we're talking about, of course, one of the people writing on this subject in modern times, Alan Bloom, in his book, The Closing of the American Mind, and pointing out that, you know, if you have young people who are wrapped up in this music that inflames their passion, that they're addicted to this, they're obsessed with this, they have to have that music, they can't be without the sound. How are you going to have these young people develop a concern about society or about the noble and important things in life? And it's almost as if this music, all-consuming, tends to simply blot out any awareness of the really important things in life. And, of course, you wait too long, and they never will, of course, have that opportunity to develop their soul, these concepts that Aristotle and Plato wrote about. Now, our telephone number, if you'd like to call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course, what is the impact of the music that we have today on our society today? Look around you and see what's happening. People know something is seriously wrong in our society, and they have no idea that we seem to be under attack on all sides, our moral values, our cultural values, but of course our cultural ties in so strongly to music. Would that be a fair statement?
I think it is a fair statement, and I think it's right to point out that ultimately this music, if we don't offer the young something different and better, the music that they are just kind of being blindly led to does incapacitate them for important experiences that we should want them to have. This music is powerful, it's pleasant to them in a very immediate kind of way. Whereas in contrast, and this is, you know, going back to Bloom, one of his concerns, the kind of pleasures of the mind that one would get from reading great literature or poetry or things like that, they take discipline. It takes a lot of attention and concentration to derive enjoyment from Dostoevsky or something like that. And we're not really preparing the young to be able to enjoy those highest and maybe purest pleasures of the mind when we allow them to kind of run riot with this music that just gives immediate gratification.
Well, of course, what was Bloom's solution to it, though? I mean, we can point out what the problem is, but how do we change it when, of course, we have a Hollywood culture, we have certainly this culture that dominates so much of what we see and hear?
Yeah, the solution is not easy, and I think it just comes down to every individual set of parents making it their responsibility to educate their children in what is beautiful and noble from the very beginning by exposing them to the best in music. I think we don't do that the way even fairly earnest and morally serious parents approach this concern, I think, is wrong in that many of them try to keep an eye on their kids, and if it turns out in their teenage years that they're listening to things that are destructive, they try to put a stop to it, which of course is better than doing nothing, but it's also acting a little bit late.
It's sort of like closing the barn door after the horses galloped off?
Exactly. What you'd rather want to do is to, again, find a way to bring them up from the cradle on so that they're, as to borrow some language from Plato, they're constantly surrounded by images of what's graceful and beautiful and noble, so that by the time they're teenagers, they'll have a taste for that. They'll have properly formed moral tastes, and then they'll be safe to let them go out into the world. And, you know, that's the thing. We live in a democracy. You can't protect them from the world forever. At some point, they're going to go out, and they're going to hear this music that's not so good. You can't stop them from hearing it, and it's very hard to get them to stop listening to it if they like it. What you can do is try to educate them in such a way that they won't like it when they finally do hear it.
Well, I think when you know something that is truly noble and beautiful, why you'll recognize something that's, that is a cheap counterfeit. Let's go to Ray calling us. Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Hi,
you have a question?
Dr. Stan. Yes, I wanted to mention something. I grew up in the era of the Beatles and Bob Dylan, and I'm a songwriter. I write some gospel, too. And I'd like to know from your guest, I'd like to know what he thinks about the influence of Bob Dylan and the Beatles on
All right. Did you get the question, Dr. Holloway? What do you think of Bob Dylan and the Beatles?
Well, you know, these are talented people and quality people, and I wouldn't want to denigrate them. Although, I would just say, let me put it this way. I've been kind of talking up the most severe principles. You got to say there's a role in human life for music that's popular, you know, and I think Aristotle recognizes that. So there's nothing wrong with pop music, and as far as pop music goes, probably the Beatles and Bob Dylan are very good. You know, they're the best it has to offer in terms of maybe the, you know, thoughtfulness of lyrics and things like that. But at the same time, I think Plato and Aristotle would challenge us to try to make our leisure, which is our playtime or our rest time in that sense, to be as serious as it can be.
I wanted to mention something that I think is kind of important. You know, the Beatles, Aleister Crowley, you know who that is.
Yeah.
He was involved in the Beatles, the album that they did, Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
He was a friend of them. He was a friend of the Beatles.
Right. Of course, for our listeners out there, Aleister Crowley was a Satanist. That's a straight and simple. And go ahead, Ray.
Well, this is what I wanted to say. I mean, I think that some of the Beatles stuff is kind of on the dark side.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think until we recognize the spiritual component in the music, we're going to be missing so much of what's going on today. And, of course, that permeates every aspect of our society today, and neither the church nor our politicians or our leaders will address the spiritual.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say, Ray?
That's it.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. for Liberty, or 464-8295. And we're talking about, of course, the impact of music on society. And, of course, I would be even more concerned with the impact of music on the church. I mean, certainly, you know, when you go to a church, you expect to see something that is inspiring, uplifting. You don't expect to go and, of course, attend a rock concert. And, you know, there's a very, very prominent church leader today who says there is no such thing as Christian music. There's only Christian lyrics. God created all music. Don't you dare criticize, or you shouldn't criticize the music that God has made. Well, when I hear some of this music, I wonder which God he's concerned about, because I believe some of this comes right out of the pit of hell, and I believe it is doing everything just the opposite from what the Christian music should be doing, and that is the upward reach of the soul towards God and the quest for nobility and virtue and courage. And I don't see that this brings that out at all. What would your thoughts be?
Well, I mean, I'm inclined to agree with you. You know, what is worship except an encounter with God? And what is God if not something that's infinitely better than we are? So it seems to me that music should create a sense of humility, or somehow give a sense of God's majesty and incomparable superiority to us. And if you're going to use pop music, basically you're just creating good feelings, kind of cheap good feelings, and self-satisfaction. And that, I mean, these are not the feelings with which I think anybody who's got their head on straight is going to approach God. So it doesn't seem appropriate to me. And moreover, I don't think it's true that God created music like he created everything, but just like everything else, human beings can pervert it. And that, you know, so I don't think that every form of music is equally valid. Just because God is the author of all things, human beings can turn things to bad purposes, and you know, it's again hard to see how a music that speaks the musical language of unrestrained passion can be ultimately, in the long run, useful in terms of forming people religiously.
And I agree with you totally. We had a fellow named Stan calling in. I don't know what happened to Stan. He must have dropped off. Maybe he'll call back again, but. You know, I think that one of the problems we see today, of course, is the way that music, I think, is having a very, very deleterious effect on society. You have a chapter called Hungry Souls. You talk about Homer Simpson. You talk about the vulgar spirit of rock. Would you like to pick up on that thought?
Yeah, what I have in mind with Hungry Souls, which is the last chapter of the book, is an explanation of why young people are so attracted to music that seems so destructive and disturbing to a lot of cultural critics. And ultimately, I think it's because their souls are hungering for a nourishment that they're not getting, and I mean a spiritual nourishment and a moral nourishment. What I think happens is, well, first of all, let me just preface it by saying this. I mean, obviously, there are people who are willing to produce music that appeals to the passions and appeals to extreme anger or lust and things like this. But you can't just blame the artists, because there's clearly a market for this stuff. I mean, they're getting rich because lots of young people want to buy it. Why do they want to buy it? I think it's because most of the education we offer to the young, and I don't just mean education in the narrow sense, but just sort of the public training and what we look up to and what is a successful life. I think a lot of that is just not worthy of our humanity and not worthy of young people. It's a lot of it's commercialism and materialism, an understanding of life that's good if it's successful in a kind of worldly sense. They don't get a rearing in what Plato and Aristotle would call nobility or greatness. And I think as a result, they naturally are dissatisfied. I think the human soul naturally does long for greatness or nobility or beauty. And when you don't give the young that, when you don't speak to their concern with that, their idealistic concern with that, they get disillusioned, and they find contemporary society or contemporary respectable culture in a lot of ways boring, and so they turn away from it. But they haven't been, again, you know, in a sense, they're right to turn away from it because it's bankrupt in some respects. But when they turn away from it, they don't know what to turn to, because again, they haven't received a kind of moral education seriously based on the right kind of music. So what can they turn to? Just to the most obvious things, which would be, you know, a kind of hedonism or reckless hedonism, or maybe ultimately to kind of angry self-assertion. I mean, all these things are more interesting than simply, you know, working a job to earn a paycheck, to buy things, you know, and do that in a kind of endless cycle until you die. So in a sense, it's a testimony to, this sounds wrong, but I hope what I mean is clear. In a sense, it's a testimony to what's good in their souls that they turn to this perverted music. It shows they're not satisfied with the cheap and easy stuff that society has to offer. But in the end, of course, that music is even more destructive and more harmful, and we need to provide a positive alternative to that.
You wrote on page 159, rock is the music of unbridled feelings. As such, rock is fiercely intolerant of at least one thing, any assertion of the reality of the transcendent and its relevance to human life. Rockers sense, and rightly, that such notions would give authority to reason to place restraints on passion, and they therefore resist any person who dares to assert any variation of this teaching, whether Plato or the Pope. And what you're saying is that certainly everybody, I think, has a sense that we need something greater than ourselves and the transcendent, the spiritual, and yet the young people are rejecting that because they don't want to be told what to do. They want the freedom to do whatever they want to without realizing that freedom without restraint leads to moral anarchy, and that's, of course, increasingly where we're headed today with so many of our youth.
That's right, and it's not only bad for society, although it certainly is, but it's bad for the people who are sucked into that way of life. I mean, Plato calls it rightly, I think, you know, the worst tyranny, he says, is the tyranny in your own soul, when you're dominated by the worst parts of yourself, and that's what they get ultimately. And the irony that I was trying to point out, too, in that passage is that a lot of people who lead a life of hedonism and enjoy the music that celebrates that life think of themselves as tolerant. But really, they're only tolerant of other hedonistic alternatives. They really hate religion and older notions of reason that suggest that there really are principles by which the passions have to be disciplined. And they react with great anger when anybody suggests that.
Well, of course, you actually teach Plato and Aristotle, is this philosophy or political science you're teaching?
I teach political science.
All right, and of course, you know, your students are lucky to get this sort of schooling they're getting, because the great tragedy of today is most of our young people are not getting a foundation in Western civilization. It really, many of these ideas start back with Plato and Aristotle.
That's right. I think the study of the foundations of our way of life is sadly neglected, and I think that's a problem if our if our democracy is going to endure. We need, again, you can't say it enough, citizens who can exercise self-control, and they can't do that if they don't understand the principles of justice and what's good, and a lot of our education doesn't even try to address those questions.
Well, how do your students respond to your teaching them, you know, these eternal truths? Because certainly much of what Plato and Aristotle wrote is as true today as it was 2,300 years ago.
Well, you know, when you teach Plato and come to the passages on music, there is a certain amount of resistance because people are, and young people are very attached to their music. And also, you know, they're Americans. So the idea that Plato suggests that music should be brought under political control is pretty alien to them. And by the way, that's not what I would suggest. I think, you know, we don't have to buy into Plato's political censorship of music to buy into his understanding that music's important and that we ought to control ourselves and our own families if we're not trying to use the law to control other people. But I think, in a way, they sense that he's right. Again, they wouldn't love music so much if it didn't have an effect on their passions and on their character, if it weren't important to their way of life. So, you know, they react with caution, but at the same time, I think, see that he's on to something.
Well, of course, I think that the rock and then the heavy metal rock and then, I don't know, I mean, it's gone from one bad to the next. It's been a slow evolution as we've seen music deteriorate over a period of time. To some of these festivals we've seen at the Super Bowls and other nationally televised programs, which I find highly offensive. Some of the things we've seen at the Olympics a few years ago certainly reminded me of the hedonistic festivals of ancient times. And so music can touch the soul, and I think that this is really the point that you make. Music can touch the soul and take us to much higher levels, or can certainly undermine the soul and take us to accept the worst of our passions. Would that be a fair statement?
That is a fair statement and a good summary, I think.
All right, fine. Well, we've got about 3 minutes more, and we'll be back here in just a moment. Our guest today has been Dr. Carson Holloway. He teaches political science, but of course he did his doctoral thesis based upon this concept of the impact of music on society. I think it's something that we ought to talk about. I think every person should be aware of it. You should understand that we're constantly being manipulated. There are people who understand the impact of music. The tragedy is that the average person does not. We'll be back here to wrap up the final 3 minutes of this program in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Carson Holloway, his book, All Shook Up. If you'd like to get it, well, you can call 888, and that is Spence what?
1-888-SPEN-PUB, so S-P-E-N-P-U-B.
SPEN-PUB, okay, and of course they probably have it on Amazon.com, but you'll get it cheaper at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. Well, what would your parting thought be for our listeners this evening? What message would you like to leave with them?
Just that I think everybody needs to recognize that even their play shapes their character. This is the great delusion that Plato and Aristotle fought against, and that we are in the grip of too. Socrates says in the Republic, they think they're not doing anything to their character because they think music is just play and they don't take it seriously. But just because we don't take it seriously doesn't mean that it's not serious. The way you entertain yourself forms who you are, and I think we need to think seriously about that and try to be the best we can be, even when we're playing and just enjoying music, and try to get the kind of music that will certainly be enjoyable, but also at the same time elevate our souls and foster the highest aspirations.
Amen to that. And of course, it's so important for the children that the children are brought up in the proper way, that they're brought up with the proper music. Because the child who's brought up with good music is not going to go over to the rock. Whereas the child who's never been schooled at all in music will be just pulled in with all of his contemporaries in school, and you'll see him walking down the street with his Walkman on, bobbing up and down, of course. Well, anyway, I want to thank you. It's been a real pleasure having you. This is the third in a series of interviews we've done with Dr. Holloway. He's been gracious enough to come on with us. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so very much for writing a book. I think it's a very important contribution.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. I enjoyed being on the show.
Good night. All right, fine. Well, our guest has been Dr. Carson Holloway, a teacher of political science, who's, of course, explored this whole scene of modern-day music. And, of course, my concern has not only been what's happening in society, but what's happening in the church. And the idea that there is no such thing as Christian music, only Christian lyrics, and that all music comes from God. Well, God certainly designed the pattern, because the music does fit into a pattern with rhythm and harmony and melody. All of these things can have an impact on the soul. But I believe that some music, this with a terrible beat in it, and the irregular and the discords, I believe this is done intentionally to bring out the very worst in us. I think it's a very, very dangerous thing, and yet it permeates so much of our society to this very day. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and once again, we come to the end of this program, and of course, we'll be doing another program the next hour, although we'll be losing some of our listeners for this hour. If you have a short wave, you can pick up the next hour that we're going to be doing at 5.745 megahertz, and that'll be heard nationwide, 5.745 megahertz. But our hope is that, of course, that many of you out there in the listening audience will realize that what we're trying to do is educate the American people about the information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw about the true spiritual nature of the battle we're involved in, because this is certainly a historical and political and cultural and ideological struggle, but it's behind all of that the spiritual forces that are at work, intent upon destroying the souls of mankind. And they're doing a pretty good job of it as we look around and see what's happening. So if you would like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARN. We are primarily listener supported. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, certainly our January newsletter, dealt with the Illuminati. What did George Washington say about the Illuminati? What did Timothy Dwight, the president of Yale University, say about the Illuminati when he wrote about it on July 4th, 1798, or he actually gave a sermon at that time at Yale University to the accumulated students, telling them about and warning them about this secret Bavarian organization which had already permeated into America, was responsible for the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794, and yet most Americans have no idea what this organization is or what it's doing today. And of course, it is part of the continuation of the ancient mystery religions that have been there since the beginning of time. Their goal, the New World Order, the New World Religion, or as we would call it today, globalization. And of course, most people have no idea anything that's going on, because they're not getting the truth from the mass media today, which is largely controlled by those people dedicated to the New World Order, the New World Religion. Well, certainly you can get our material. You can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. Watch our video, Iraq, The Untold Story of Brotherhood of Darkness. Megiddo, The March to Armageddon. The infiltration of our churches, this movement that is spreading throughout the Protestant church called the Church Growth Movement, a technique of learning how to manipulate Christians and replace their didactic thinking or didactic teaching with dialectic teaching, teaching that came from the concepts of Hegel, who was the father of modern-day dialectics, where, of course, we convince Christians that they've got to be willing to be more tolerant, to be willing to understand how other people think, to realize that there may be other ways to God, and how can we possibly be critical of other people? And, well, either Christianity is true and there's only one way to God, or of course, Christianity is a lie, and I prefer to believe it's true, and I believe there is only one way to God. But when I see our Christian leaders compromising their positions, because, after all, we wouldn't want to be intolerant. And if you doubt that our Christian leaders have compromised the position, we have something called the Amazing Clips. The Amazing Clips, where you'll see America's leading Christian today saying, you don't have to be a Christian to go to heaven, and so many other things. So you'd be amazed at all the people pushing for the New World Order, the New World Religion. The religious leaders are leading us into this one world religion, which of course means that Christianity will have to be compromised. Well, all of these things are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We do hope that many of you will go to our website, which is RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours every day. And of course, you can also get the archives if after 5 hours you haven't had enough. But what we want you to do is tell others, encourage them to listen, and help us to spread the truth across America. That we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. Please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Arthur Burnclaw, from who works with veterans. And, of course, he's going to be talking this evening about the 2004 defense budget. Now, of course, the veterans, people who've dedicated their lives and many times risked their lives for fighting for this country. And you would expect that the country would take care of those veterans as they promised to. Many of them, of course, served their 20 or 30 years in the military, promised free medical care for the rest of their lives and a pension. But, of course, those promises, and sometimes a couple of dollars to buy a cup of coffee. There is an organized effort to cut back on medical care for our veterans as we squander our money throughout the world on some of the most incredible things. In fact, some of the things that are being financed by under the name of science, of having women watching pornographic movies. You know, you wonder what in the heaven's name these people can be. Think of, I think that was $175,000 to get women's response to pornographic movies. We are wasting all sorts of money. We're financing countries throughout the world. And, of course, we're ignoring our veterans. Arthur Burnclaw, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, a pleasure. And I think you called it like it really was on our last program we did together, February 3rd, when you said we're dealing with a bunch of empire builders.
Well, I think that that is very true. I think that there are people who have a different worldview. I think most Americans would like to be left alone and live our own lives. But there are people who really believe in an American empire. They are trying to establish a Pax Americana, just exactly as the Romans did 2,000 years ago with a Pax Romana. The difficulty is, we know what happened to Rome. Their soldiers were all off fighting throughout the rest of the empire when the Huns streamed in the streets of Rome.
And it's happening again, because the barbarians are at the gate.
Amen.
It's happening again.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about the 2004 defense budget.
Okay, I'm going to leave a few minutes toward the end of the program to read a fax that I got from United Press International about what's going on with Operation Iraqi Freedom. So if you can remind me if I start getting too deep into it toward the end of the program, I'd like to read this fax that came into me from UPI.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, the defense program. Okay. Now, while Congress was telling disabled veterans that there is no money for them to end the 100% tax placed on the Department of Defense funded pensions, the pensions from people in the service were put in 20 to 30 years, that money comes from the Department of Defense. Congress was telling disabled vets there's no money for them to end the 100% tax placed on their DOD-funded pensions, to then be used to pay their own VA disability compensation or to fully fund the cost of their VA health care. Now, Senator McCain, who this time plays the good guy, Senator McCain finds, and he rightly condemns, $6.5 billion of pork in the 2004 defense bill. While disabled veterans suffer and more disabled vets arrive from Iraq daily, Congress has clearly shown that they could care less about those who defend us now and in the past. And so much for this administration's compassionate conservatism.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Arthur Burnclaw as he expresses his concern as a disabled veteran for what's befalling our veterans today. Our guest this evening, Arthur Burnclaw, and what's the name of your organization, Arthur?
It's Veterans for Constitutional Law.
Okay, Veterans for Constitutional Law. And so you were saying, of course, that we're being told there's just no money at all for to take care of the veterans that have been guaranteed lifetime care. But
exactly.
Simply, we've already invested several hundred billion dollars over in Baghdad. And
$200 billion.
Right, and of course Halliburton, which of course is still paying Dick Cheney a deferred salary of $150,000 a year, according to the latest New Yorker magazine. Halliburton is it, you know, making an extra $67 million here. Well, maybe we're going to have to give part of that back. And I mean, Halliburton and these great corporations are making out like bandits, but there's no money for our own people here. I mean, they just got another contract for $6 or $7 billion with no competition, no competitive bidding, because after all, there's nobody smart enough to do what Halliburton can do, or maybe has high enough connections to get away with what it's getting away with.
Well, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be laughable. If it wasn't so tragic. Now, the American public is not aware of the fact that when somebody puts in 20 to 30 years and they retire from the military, their pension comes from the Department of Defense. Now, should they become injured in the line of duty while putting in that 20 to 30 years and be unemployable and they have serious injuries coming from that, they will pay you a disability compensation. After you fight them for many, many years, they will finally relent and pay you a disability compensation. But what the public doesn't realize that for every dollar in disability compensation they pay you, they deduct a dollar off your pension. So in essence, retired disabled veterans have 100% tax placed on their Department of Defense funded pensions, and they have to pay their own disability compensation. It's really unfair. Now, this statement, it's on the fiscal year 2004, the Defense Appropriations Conference report, and it's in the words of Senator McCain, who I've often fought with and feuded with on many, many occasions for many, many reasons, particularly the prisoner of war issue. And
Let's call it a betrayal. Let's just not sugarcoat it. It's a betrayal. It's a prisoner of war betrayal,
exactly.
And McCain's been on the side of the Viet Cong.
Yep. But his, in his words, and for once he plays the good guy. I'm glad to see he played the good guy this time.
All right, I am too.
Mr. President, I rise today.
Hold that for just one moment. Let's bring the rest of our... All right, we've got the rest of our stations on board. Our guest is Arthur Burncloud. Go ahead, Arthur.
Okay, in the words of Senator McCain, Mr. President, I rise today to address the conference report for the fiscal year 2004 Department of Defense Appropriation Bill. As has become the standard practice for appropriations matters, this legislation is loaded with pork, catered to the parochial needs of the members and special interests, and not the interests of our soldiers and sailors. I feel it is important. I come to the floor of the Senate to draw attention to this legislation. In a time when American troops are stretched across the globe, including major commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan, not to mention the enormous budget deficits we must face at home, we should be devoting critical defense dollars to urgent defense priorities. Apparently, the appropriators do not share this philosophy. In this year's version of the legislation, there is over $6.5 billion in member adds. These are not in the president's budget. These are not on the unfunded priority list and not on the Pentagon's long-range defense budget. Defense dollars would be better used to help our disabled veterans who are discriminated against because they are prohibited against receiving both retirement and disability pay. Full concurrent receipt. Concurrent receipt is the payment of both to veterans who deserve it. Would cost the government $3.5 billion at the very most annually, which is approximately half of the total pork that is in this bill. There's so much pork in this bill that I couldn't flip a page without hearing it squeal. Well, let me remind my colleagues of the role of the Appropriations Committee. The responsibility of the authorizers and appropriators are expected to be distinct. The role of the Senate Armed Services Committee is to establish policy and funding levels and to oversee the Department of Defense and its programs. The role of the Appropriations Committee is to allocate funding based on policies provided by authorization bills. The appropriator's function today, however, has expanded dramatically, and the Appropriations Committee now engages in significant policy decision-making and micromanagement, usurping the role of the authorizing committees. I recognize that the failure of authorizing committees to pass authorizing legislation contributes to the broken system, and that often appropriators have no choice but to fund unauthorized programs and take it upon themselves to make policy determinations. Now, on September 17th, the Comptroller of the United States, David Walker, delivered a speech at the National Press Club.
No, I'm sorry. Are you still quoting McCain, or are you going to something else?
No, this is still McCain.
Okay, go ahead.
On September 17th, the Comptroller of the United States, David Walker, delivered a speech at the National Press Club, according to the head of the Government Accounting Office. David Walker said, "We must begin to come to grips with the daunting fiscal realities that threaten our nation's children and grandchildren's future." Mr. Walker cited $401 billion and $480 billion for the unified budget deficits for fiscal years 2003 and 2004, respectively. Now, if you take out and remove the Social Security surplus, those numbers jump up to $562 billion and $644 billion, respectively.
Now, what you're saying is, go ahead, what they're really doing is they're stealing the money from Social Security and spending
it.
It doesn't go on budget. Go ahead.
Yeah. But this is the real, if it wasn't for the Social Security surplus, this is what the figures would be, $562 billion and $644 billion, respectively. Now, more important, the cost of the $87 billion war supplemental are not even factored into these numbers. In addition to this money, there are a number of financial liabilities the federal government has to pay out. But but are not counted against the budget, such as Medicare trust funds and health care benefit costs provided through the VA. This leads Mr. Walker to state, "We are starting off in a financial hole. We really don't have a very good picture of how deep it is." His suggestion, "It is time to admit that we are in a fiscal hole and stop digging the hole deeper." Now, Senator McCain goes on now to say, "Mr. President, it seems as if everybody in this country is watching reality television these days. The Senate proceedings on C-SPAN is not reality television. What you are watching is definitely unreal. You are watching senators who just don't care about this budget deficit we're running in the face of huge deficits." It also took the House of Representatives, now get this, Dr. Stan, on a similar bill. It also took the House of Representatives only 7 minutes to pass a bill that is nearly 400 pages long and includes $368 billion. It does not get any more irresponsible than this. Legislators are abdicating their responsibility. This is significantly burdening our taxpayers. Now, here are some of the more egregious examples of pork in this legislation. This is incredible. $135 million for advanced procurement of the LPD-17. Now, are you going to ask me what the LPD-17 is?
What is an LPD-17?
I really don't know, and neither do the senators who passed this thing. I asked five different senators, "What is the LPD-17?" and I couldn't get an answer out of any of them. Okay, that's $135 million for advanced procurement of the LPD-17, and these senators didn't even know what it was. Okay, $8.1 million for the 21st century truck. Now, this program finds its way onto the Defense Appropriations Act every year and also on the pork list. $4.3 million for the Army Smart Truck. Now, after all these years on the pork list, one would believe that if this truck was so smart, it would find a way to fund itself by now. $1 million for the Young Patriots Program. This is a program by the National Flag Foundation to expand Young Patriots programs to include a video which promotes the significance of national patriotic holidays. Now, I love our patriotic holidays as much as the next guy, but $1 million to watch a video on national patriotic holidays? Come on now. $1 million for Shakespeare and the American Military Committee. I spoke out against this ad during debate on the Senate version of this legislation, and to my shock and surprise, this has found its way into the final version of the legislation. This was all passed, by the way. Everything on here was passed. $1.8 million for the Canola Fuel Cell Initiative. $5.6 million for armored security vehicles. This is a program that was canceled 4 years ago, and I'm sure that the 1,000 Humvees that are in the upcoming war supplemental will cover the requirement for military police in Iraq and Afghanistan. $1 million for the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Activities. Sounds like an urgent defense need to me. $7.5 million for the Joint Advertising Market Research and Studies Program. I can't wait to see the commercials that come from this money. $3 million for United States-made bayonets. Once again, Buy America provisions have found their way into the bill. $6 million for the procurement of lightweight armor for the CH-46. The conferees mention the use of Kevlar, a DuPont product, making this not only pork, but another Buy America provision. $43 million for UC-35B executive aircraft. This is so the big shot politicians here could fly anywhere around the country or around the world that they want. $43 million. Okay, once again, the districts represented by our colleagues on the Appropriation Committee were taken care of in this bill. Let's look at Alaska.
Now that would be Senator Stevens, of course.
Yep, Senator Stevens and Senator Murkowski. Okay, Alaska, $33.1 million for the Allen Army Airfield upgrades. $8.9 million for hybrid electric vehicle testing only at the Cold Region Testing Facility. $18.7 million for Fort Wainwright Central Heat and Power Plant renovation. That's $18.7 million for a renovation on the plant. Okay, $9 million for the Fort Wainwright Utilidor. $500,000 for the Elmendorf Air Force Base Community Center enhancements.
Now, I assume these are all in Alaska.
Yep, all these I'm mentioning are right here
okay,
in Alaska.
Go right ahead.
They made out pretty well in this.
Well, I think that our listeners must understand that Senator Stevens is in charge of the House Appropriations Committee,
yep.
And of course he always, of course, uses his power to shuttle a great deal of money to Alaska so that the state will be prosperous, spending your tax money so he'll get reelected. And he is certainly, of all the senators, he is the worst one as far as taking advantage of the system, and yet, of course, he gets elected year after year after year.
Oh, he's got a job for life over there. Anyway, $5 million for the Port of Anchorage Intermodal Marine Facility Project. $5.8 million for the Alaska-wide Mobile Radio Program. $8 million and up to $26 million, if necessary, for railroad track realignment at the Air Force Managed Ranges in Alaska. Now, Kentucky made out pretty well, too, in this legislation. $1.2 million for Fort Knox University of Mounted Warfare Campus Area Network Infrastructure. $1 million, make a note here, we really don't have mounted warfare anymore. $1 million for the University of Mounted Warfare Classroom Automation.
Hold that thought right there, Arthur. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Arthur Bernclough. Of course, we're talking about the excessive, just waste of money in this latest the Defense Department legislation. And the way this works is, of course, Senator Stevens of Alaska says, well, if you don't vote for everything I want for Alaska, none of the projects that you want for your community are going to get through. So he's always assured of getting... because he's the head of the appropriations, the Senate Appropriations Committee, he's always sure of getting everything he wants for Alaska through. And this is why, of course, there's so much money going to Alaska. And it's not that none of these things are absolutely necessary. And why should I, living in California, vote for all these things being done in Alaska? Why, no reason at all. But, of course, this has nothing to do with what's right or what's wrong. It has to do with the corruption of our system by senators who has allegiance to their, basically, to themselves and their power structure rather than to our country. And the fact that most of the senators go along with this, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine, you give me something for my community, I'll vote for something for your state. This is the way the system works, and it's wrong, it's immoral, and the trouble is we've got an awful lot of immoral people serving in the United States Senate. Go ahead, Arthur.
Okay, $1 million for gauntlet training and instrumentation facility upgrade at Fort Knox. $2 million for instrumentation, another mounted facility at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Some other areas, some other states also fared well. Although, Kentucky didn't do as well as Alaska. Nobody did. $1.4 million for the Langley Air Force Base Visitor Center in Virginia. $500,000, now this I don't understand, this one, nor does any of the senators I spoke to. $500,000 for people movers at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. Do you know what a people mover is?
Yeah, they're these, they're almost like an escalator, only it's flat. And you lay this thing out, it's got a mat on it, and the mat moves forward. And so you can move people very, very rapidly. They have them at the airports. They call them people movers.
Why didn't five senators know what people movers are?
Well, they're
are?
Not as smart as I am. They should listen to Radio Liberty. Go ahead.
I believe you. $2.2 million for Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. Facility is practically closed, okay? $500,000 for a hangar at the closed Griffiths Air Force Base in New York. $6 million for Fitzsimmons Medical Center in Colorado. I have to tell you, Fitzsimmons Medical Center in Colorado is under very heavy investigation for corruption and waste of money, yet here we are giving another $6 million into Fitzsimmons Medical Center in Colorado. $4.9 million for McClellan Air Force Base remediation in Colorado. $1.5 million for David's Island Fort Slocum remediation. $17 million for a grant to the Silver Valley Unified School District for the purpose of school construction at Fort Irwin, California. $4 million for preventing the disestablishment of the 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron of the Air Force Reserve stationed in Mississippi. $4 million. That's actually a totally useless installation down there. Actually totally useless. They threw another $4 million into it. Okay, $3 million for Riverbank, California Army Ammunition Plant.
Hold that thought right there, Arthur. And our... All right, fine. Our guest is Arthur Bernclough, and we're talking about the wasteful appropriations all across America for Army bases and for... These are simply boondoggles, a means of funneling money in. This is not coming out of the general Army budget, and these are being tacked on for work. And, of course, this is what's known as pork. We throw a lot of money into our area. It stimulates the economy. And if I'm the representative of that area, why, everybody's going to be happy because there are lots of jobs. Go ahead, pick up the story. And, of course, this is one of the major things today. How do we get people working? Why we have a lot of make-work jobs that don't accomplish much of anything, but they've got to keep the economy going through November. Because the last thing we would want would be the people to stop and think about what's happening, they might not vote for Socialist Party A or Socialist Party B. They might even start letting the American people know that the electoral process has been co-opted by people who control both political parties, both dedicated to globalization, both dedicated to transferring our jobs overseas, both dedicated to transferring our industries overseas, both dedicated to redistribution of the wealth of the middle class of America. So pick up the story, Arthur.
Okay, $3 million for the Riverbank, California Army Ammunition Plant Flexible Manufacturing Facility. $1.4 million upgrades to the telecommunications infrastructure at Fort Lewis, Washington. $1 million for upgrades to the telecommunications infrastructure at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. $1.4 million for Rock Island Arsenal, Illinois AIT Initiative. $5 million for local area network upgrades at Fort Drum, New York. That's a National Guard installation. $700,000 for an emergency mission module for the Nevada National Guard. $1.75 million for the Pacific Northwest Undersea Range Support. Now get this one. $45.7 million for the Maui Space Surveillance System.
Now what is the Maui Space Surveillance System?
It's not worth $45.7 million. It's a surveillance system when we shoot off any kind of
Satellite
out there, and it's our Pacific Coast space surveillance system.
Right,
it's in Maui, Hawaii. That's the biggest one we have out there in Maui, Hawaii.
All right, fine. They're probably monitoring then the rockets as they go up.
$45.7 million. By the way, that is supposed to be complete. They've got everything there is in there, and they don't need nothing else. But somehow, they got $45.7 million more. Okay, in addition, the defense appropriators have decided to fund the nation's health care needs through the Department of Defense Appropriations Act. Now, I'm sure the appropriators responsible for the labor and the HHS bill are grateful that their workload has been reduced by their colleagues on the defense subcommittee. Now, once again, I emphasize that many of these programs represent important projects. I have problems with the way they are funded. If any senator could please point out the urgent defense need for any of these programs to me, or to the president, so he can request funds for these programs in next year's defense budget, I would be grateful.
No, but this is about $6 billion all told.
$6.5 billion of pure pork, which was not necessary to the defense budget.
All right, it wasn't something the Army had requested. These were the things that the senators requested for their individual districts to keep everybody happy, and, of course, so they'll get reelected.
Right. The Army didn't request it. The president didn't request it, and it's not in the long-range plans for anyone else to request it. Now, the following, it's but a small sample of the unrequested member ads related to health care. $23 million for the Hawaii Federal Health Care Network. $2.5 million for the Alaska Federal Health Care Network. Alaska got underfunded compared with their friends in Hawaii for this one. $1 million for the brown tree snakes, otherwise known as the best-funded snakes in the United States. $1.4 million for the minimally invasive surgery program in Ohio. $2.5 million for the health study at the Iowa Army Ammunition Plant. I didn't even know they had an ammunition plant in Iowa. Okay, $4.5 million for the Pacific Island Healthcare Network. $150 million for the Army Peer-Reviewed Breast Cancer Research Program.
Well, I can see why this is such an important issue, breast cancer among...
Absolutely, but not on a defense bill.
We'll be right back here in just a moment or two with Mr. Arthur Bernklaub. And we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, Martha Bernclau for with Veterans for Constitutional Law, and of course we're talking about the House appropriations or the recent Defense Department appropriations legislation. So, Arthur, go ahead and pick up the story from there.
Yeah, you're right about it being very important for breast cancer research, but why on a defense bill? It doesn't belong there. $85 million for the Army peer-reviewed prostate cancer research program. $3 million for complementary and alternative medicine. Now, Senator McCain goes on to say...
Now, this is all in Senator McCain's speech, is that it?
Yeah, except for the last the last paragraph, which is mine.
All right, go ahead.
I have a serious concern that extended deployments will lead to retention problems if we do not work to ensure that we take care of our soldiers and sailors. In other words, he has a serious concern that we might not be able to keep people in the service. We're having a very difficult time in keeping people in the service. They don't stay in anymore for 20 to 30 years. A lot of them leave early to get out and take a civilian job now. By providing our service members with adequate benefits, we help ensure that our military will not face retention problems. We have a military force that continues to rely on the reserve components, men and women in the National Guard and reserves to go to war and to perform other critical military tasks abroad and at home. Many combat support groups, other support missions are being carried on the backs of our active and reserve component forces. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, they're performing very vital tasks during these periods of deployment, including direct involvement in military operations in Iraq, guarding nuclear power plants, supporting the war on terrorism, fighting fires in our western states, augmenting aircraft carriers, short on active-duty sailors with critical skilled enlisted ratings during sea exercises and rebuilding schools. That's very important. This aircraft carrier, they're very short on people to operate aircraft carriers. Now, Mr. President, I look forward to the day that I do not have to criticize the unrequested spendings in appropriation bills. Let's commit to devoting taxpayers' money only to critical needs in the future. Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, and my own comment is, if the American taxpayers and voters do not wake up and put a stop to all this pork that's stuffing our appropriations bills, our children and our grandchildren will inherit this debt for many generations to come. We must do everything that we can.
Hold that thought, Arthur. We'll be right back. All right, fine. And, of course, Arthur Bernclau is just talking about the Senator McCain's speech that he gave before the Senate. And, of course, I'm sure you can get a complete copy of that from Arthur if you'd like to. But the great tragedy is we're wasting money. It's pork, over $6 billion. And, of course, Senator McCain is saying, if we don't wake up and do something about this, our children and our children's children are going to inherit this mammoth debt.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, if the American taxpayers and voters do not wake up and put a stop to all this pork that's stuffing our appropriations bills, our children and our grandchildren will inherit this debt for many generations to come. We must do everything that we can to end this regional greed and all this insane, unnecessary spending by our elected Congress and the Senate now before it's too late. And I'd like to thank Veterans Advocate Tony Woody of Exeter, New Hampshire. He's a retired Navy veteran who's helped me personally compile this vital information for this program. And I'm Arthur Bernclau. I'm Executive Director of Veterans for Constitutional Law.
Why don't you get your address out there, Arthur?
Okay, I can be reached at 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York, 11777, or by phone at 631 area, 474-4261, 631 area, 474-4261, or I can be faxed at 631-474-1968. And I would like to hear your comments on what I have spoken about here. Usually I take a whack at the VA and the Department of Defense and the service organizations, but I felt this defense bill was very necessary to talk about because most people are not aware of the waste that is going on now in Congress and the Senate.
Well, not only that, but they're not being honest with us. They put this budget through, and of course, they're not going to tell you all the other money that's going to have to be spent,
right.
And they're not going to let this out until after the election. Now, the budget you're talking about, I think, was about pretty close to a $500 billion deficit for the year 2004, except that they didn't put in the Social Security and Medicare money they're going to steal and spend so that they don't have to raise your taxes, and yet they can continue spending the money.
Exactly.
The problem is that with all, even with that, and you're talking now, we're up around $700 billion, almost $1 trillion. The military has recently said there isn't enough money in that budget to maintain our activities over in Iraq. So there's going to have to be another $50 billion that will be tacked on. And you just wait until after the November elections. It doesn't matter who's going to win. Then they're going to announce that there's another $50 billion. So that's going to be pretty close to $700 trillion, maybe even closer to a quarter of a trillion dollars that we're going to be in deficit in this one year. You cannot maintain a deficit of that degree indefinitely. It took the United States from 1789 until 1980 to run up $1 trillion in debt. Jimmy Carter, with all of his spendthrift policies, added $200 billion to our budget in the 4 years he was in office. George Bush will add certainly between $600 and $700 billion to our deficit in simply 1 year. And this, of course, is this ill-guided adventure, this war in Iraq, when we'd been keeping Saddam Hussein in power. That's another story, but anybody who doubts that needs to get the book, The See No Evil by Robert Baer, who is a CIA agent. He will tell you what he was told by every Iraqi he met. They all believed the United States was keeping Saddam in power. In fact, some of them, according to our Robert Baer, believed he was a CIA operative. Maybe nothing as it appears to be. You need to get that book.
We were keeping him in power, Dr. Stan.
Right.
We were totally keeping this man in power. It was us that kept him in power.
And now, of course, we spend all this money to get him out of power. Something's wrong with this. And of course, what we're doing in the process is bankrupting this country. There is no way we will ever pay off this debt.
It's an incredible quagmire. The deeper we get, the deeper we're going to get. There's no end to this, Dr. Stan. There is no end to this. The solution is pull out of there, get out while we can, because this is not going to end.
Well, we have no intention of pulling out, though.
The plan
is to permanently station troops in the Middle East. How many there'll be, I can't tell you, but that's the plan. Now, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you're out in the audience, you say, how can you make a statement like that? Let me suggest you go to their website. By them, I mean the Project for the New American Century. Their website is newamericancentury.org. Who are they? Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, William Kristol, and of course the large number of people, there are about 30, 40 of them who are really the very center of the current administration. And you look at the report that they put out in the year 2000, January of 2000, called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and they will tell you quite openly there, and you'll find this quoted in my latest newsletter. That's the February newsletter. We'll be glad to send you a free copy so you can actually check the exact page numbers from what I'm saying. But they're in essence saying it has long been our desire to have a permanent presence in the Middle East. And this certainly, although the current conflict with Saddam Hussein may justify this, our desire to be in the Middle East transcends the regime of Saddam Hussein. In other words, it doesn't matter whether he's in power or not. We want a permanent presence in the Middle East. And this is going to bankrupt America. This is a long-range plan by people who have a different vision of the world than the average American, and I fear that their vision will lead to the bankruptcy of this country, and the only way to pay off that debt is to destroy the value of the American dollar, and with that, to impoverish our middle class.
Dr. Stan, how would you like to play cards with those guys?
Well,
you'd have to count the fingers on your dealing hand after every hand.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And again, that website, newamericancentury.org, the report, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Get it, read it, and if you want the exact page reference for what we've talked about, of course, give us a call. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of my February newsletter. That's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. So go ahead and pick this up, your story.
Okay,
because my concern is that, of course, what they're doing is wasting money on all sorts of things. But one of the really important things that they should be doing in taking care of our veterans, why they took something like $15 billion out of the veterans budget, and they're going to give it to what, AIDS in Africa or something?
Yep. And also building roads in New Mexico. They're giving that through Senator Peter Domenici, building roads in New Mexico.
Okay.
Okay, now I received a proactive news alert from United Press International. And this is entitled, GI Denied Healthcare After Speaking Out. Your byline is Mark Benjamin of the United Press International, and it was published March the 1st, 2004 at 6:38 p.m. Washington, March 1st. An Operation Iraqi Freedom veteran says Army officials at Fort Knox, Kentucky, refused him medical treatment after he talked publicly about poor care at the base, which helped spark hearings in Congress. Fort Knox officials charged that soldier, Lieutenant Julian Goodrum, with being absent without leave and cut off his pay after he then went to a private doctor who hospitalized him for serious mental stress from Iraq, Goodrum said. They're coming after me pretty bad, said Goodrum, 33, a veteran who has served the military for more than 14 years, including the first Gulf War and Operation Iraqi Freedom. He showed United Press International a form from Fort Knox that states that Fort Knox officials do not want him in medical hold. Now, some soldiers are kept on medical hold during treatment while the Army determines their status. Goodrum has now been hospitalized in a locked mental ward at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., after turning himself in there February 9th. Doctors there say he has post-traumatic stress disorder from Iraq and major depression, and they worry he could hurt himself. He is not allowed to go down the hall from inpatient psychiatric clinic for a Coke without an escort. Goodrum said stress from Iraq and the way he has been treated by the military since he returned has made him so depressed he's lucky to be alive. He also has injuries to both wrists in part from loading 65-pound shells on the USS Missouri when he was in the Navy in the first Gulf War. The ship pounded Iraqi troops in Kuwait and took fire from Iraqi tanks. Goodrum appeared in an October 29th UP article about more than 400 soldiers on medical hold at Fort Knox who are waiting weeks and weeks and sometimes even months for medical treatment. That article and an article on a similar situation in Fort Stewart, Georgia, sparked a series of hearings in Congress, including a January 21st appearance by Colonel Keith Armstrong, a garrison commander at Fort Knox, before a panel of the House Armed Services Committee. Fort Knox spokeswoman Connie Schaffery said privacy rules, they always do this, the government, privacy rules prohibit her from commenting on Goodrum's case unless he signed a waiver saying otherwise. He declined. Schaffery said a soldier who does not show up for duty is absent without leave. If a soldier is not at his or her duty station and is not on authorized leave or past status, he is absent without leave, Schaffery said. When a soldier is listed as AWOL, it stops all pay and benefits. When instructed to return and they do not comply immediately, that is a violation. After appearing in the UPI article on October 29th, Goodrum asked for medical care on or about November 7th. He said he told Fort Knox officials that he was having a breakdown. I said I was having problems. I told him I felt like I was having a breakdown right there, Goodrum said. Goodrum said Fort Knox told him to go away. The handwritten note in Goodrum's record for November 7th said, Colonel Stevens does not want this patient to be in medical hold. Goodrum said he then drove down an interstate highway at only 5 miles an hour through rushing traffic. He said he was completely dysfunctional because of a combination of PTSD and what he said was retribution from his chain of command for speaking up about poor medical care at the base. Said he could have wound up dead. A truck could have run right over me, Goodrum said about that day. It was a complete nervous breakdown. Now, Goodrum is a member of the Army Reserve, as a member of the Army Reserve, was named the 176th Mass Maintenance Battalion Soldier of the Year in 2001, and he has received a host of awards, including the Combat Action Ribbon and positive reviews from superior officers. This Goodrum is not a malcontent. Lieutenant Goodrum is a truly outstanding junior officer, reads one performance evaluation from 2002. In addition to his technical competence, he demonstrates great leadership potential. Promote to captain and select for advanced military schooling. Goodrum said his problems began in Iraq, working under combat conditions in a transportation company. There, he said, safety violations, including the use of deadlined or broken vehicles, resulted in the death of a 22-year-old soldier. Goodrum appealed to the Army's Inspector General, fat chance of that, and Congress when he returned home. After Goodrum sought medical help at Fort Knox on November 7th and was denied, Goodrum's civilian doctor hospitalized him for PTSD and alerted Fort Knox to this.
Now, of course, that's post-traumatic stress syndrome, right?
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
Dr. Vijay Jethanandani. Jethanandani, sounds like he may come from India, wrote Fort Knox November 15th that Goodrum needed medical leave until December 7th. The doctor kept officials there up to date on Goodrum's condition in a series of 5 letters. Unfortunately, recent intimidation, threats of being arrested for staying on medical leave from his superiors, has resulted in recurrent psychiatric symptoms, Jethanandani wrote December 3rd, until November 26, 03. Mr. Julian Goodrum was progressing, Lieutenant Julian Goodrum was progressing fairly well. It does not help that Mr. Goodrum was in combat with a unit in Iraq where a superior officer ignored safety protocol, jeopardizing the safety of soldiers and resulting in the death of one man, Jethanandani wrote. Instead of following up on his complaints, it appears that some of his superiors on stateside may be penalizing him for reporting his superior officer in Iraq. In the wake of the Fort Stewart and Fort Knox stories last fall, Undersecretary of Defense David S.C. Chu ordered that if medical care were not available on base, medical commanders shall promptly refer patients to other military, veterans affairs, or civilian sources of care. Goodrum said he showed Chu's memo to Fort Knox officials, but it did not help. I told them they were ignoring an order from the Undersecretary of Defense, Goodrum said. Goodrum's medical files shows that Walter Reed medical staff also has been unable to get Fort Knox medical officials to discuss the case. Patient is currently assigned to the medical hold company in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and to a Captain Savage. Captain Savage, all these months, has not returned any phone calls from this office, his record states. Soldiers at Fort Knox contacted UPI about another situation they consider a sign of poor care. On February 11th, a soldier on medical hold at Fort Knox, who served in Iraq, apparently attempted suicide in the barracks. He was attached to a special forces unit in Iraq. Soldiers there said he deeply slashed both of his wrists, spraying blood in the barracks hallway and around his room before being rushed to the hospital. If it was not for three guys, if they had not applied direct pressure and immediate pressure, he would have died, said one soldier at Fort Knox who knows him. Now, soldiers say they worry that Army officials did not act aggressively to address his problems, including heavy drinking, that appears to have surfaced since he got back from Iraq.
Well, of course, Arthur, the thing is that war is hell, and these young men being set off into a situation like this, this is not normal at all. It's totally abnormal, and the special forces are under tremendous pressure. They're a train to kill. They go in, they kill, they do all these things which are totally against the normal impulses of normal people. And yet, of course, they're ordered to do this by their superiors. That's their job. And, of course, when you go to war, the two purposes of an army is to kill things and destroy and things. And the army's very good at that. But in the process, it destroys sure an awful lot of our own men. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this program. Arthur, let's get out that telephone number just one more time.
Okay. It's telephone number is 631-474-4261. I would appreciate all your comments on what I had to say here. And we're here to help veterans. This is our job. This is our only job.
And, of course, the thing is, the veteran today is in a very, very difficult position. They're cutting back on veterans at benefits. At the same time, we're committing more and more men into battle. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening has been Arthur Bernclough. He's been talking about, of course, the defense budget for the year 2004, and then, of course, the problem that some of our veterans are having when they're coming back from overseas. And apparently, in many of these holding facilities, they just don't have the time, the facilities, or the inclination to get the people right in for treatment. And many of these people are waiting for weeks at a time after returning from that hellhole of Iraq to get back here for medical treatment, and it's not readily available. Is that the impression you're having, Arthur?
Yes, absolutely. That's the exact impression, and that's what's really going on. And these are our freshly returning troops, just freshly returning. On guys who have been out for a while, we're hearing all kinds of horror stories. We had a man who was the head of Helping American Veterans, a fellow by the name of William Boone out in Georgia, who was had a very bad case of diabetes and had to have his leg amputated. And they amputated his leg, and instead of taking him for physical therapy and fitting him for a prosthetic leg, they stuck him away in a room for a year and a half. No physical therapy, no prosthetic leg. Every time he asked for a prosthetic leg, they harassed him until somebody got a cell phone to him, and he contacted me, and I contacted somebody in turn in Alabama who came down, picked him up, and took him over to Alabama. And now he is a patient at the Tuskegee Veterans Hospital, and he's getting his physical therapy, and he's getting fitted for a prosthetic leg. But what I'm trying to say is a veteran in the state of Georgia can't get his benefits for some reason. And this is the same state of Georgia where they just put the end of 2002, they just put the 12 people from the Georgia VA, 12 rating board members in prison for a $11.2 million scam of stealing money from the families of dead veterans. This is the same Atlanta regional office.
All right, fine. We're out of time, Arthur. I want to thank you so very much for being here, a guest on Radio Liberty. And I guess our guest, again, our guest has been Arthur Bernclough for the Veterans for Constitutional Law. His telephone number is 631-474-4261, and they're there. They operate to try to make sure veterans are getting proper care. And my very serious concern is that there is increasingly a tendency to ignore the needs of the veterans because, of course, of our imperialistic wars. Arthur, thanks so much for being with us again.
And thank you very much, Dr. Stan, for giving us the opportunity to let your listening audience know what's really going on.
Good night, Dr. Stan. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, it's a little disconcerting when you hear all about all the pork, but this is the way the game is really played. And it's about time we had some moral people there in Washington, D.C. representing the people, rather than political hacks who are there to feather their own nest. And remember Lyndon Johnson, when he went back to Washington, D.C. as a congressman from Texas, he had to borrow money to get there, and when he returned from Washington, D.C., he was one of the wealthiest men in Texas. How did he do that on a congressman and then a senator's and then on a president's limited salary? why, of course, it was the side benefits that come with serving in Congress. Well, tragically, we have some of the finest politicians in Washington, D.C. today that money can buy. Well, this is the time when we want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and that you will help us in our endeavor to reach out across America with the truth, the story you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Dan Rather, or Tom Brokaw. As you know, today we're available. Our programs can be heard 4 hours a day on shortwave. They can be heard 5 hours a day on the Internet. So we have the opportunity to reach people across America. We just need your help to continue doing what we're doing. Our programs are heard in about 60 stations or 60 outlets every week. So we have a network, but we need, of course, to maintain that network, and we'll appreciate your help and your prayers in that vein. And then, of course, we hope many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen to our programs, you can listen to our archive, you can see lists of all the various programs that we have, where we are, the various items that we carry to help finance what we do. And, of course, you can pull down our old newsletters going back to the mid-1990s, copy them, distribute them, check out the facts, make sure that we're telling it is true, and if you need documentation on anything we say, why, feel free to get in touch with us. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Remember that the video, the Diaprax in the Church, the story of the church growth movement, the movement that is sweeping the Christian churches of America and the Western world, aimed at the transformation of the individual, the transformation of the church, the transformation of America, the transformation of society as a whole and the world. This is a pretty Diaprax in the Church will explain to you how they are substituting dialectic thinking for didactic thinking and didactic teaching. This is one of the most dangerous movements we've ever had, because it's all based upon manipulation, techniques of management that work in the corporate world and now have been introduced into the churches, and it is all about manipulation of the individual. And, of course, they're using the same techniques you would use on people who have emotional problems, the small group concepts, but we're using them on normal people. And we're going to be creating disease in people and changing their attitudes and eroding their ability to stand up for what they believe in, for the absolutes, because there are absolutes, there is a God. But once you get into the small group and you're faced with the two options of standing for what you believe in or compromising and going along with the consensus building, why, of course, you begin to back away from the idea there's only one way to heaven, and that's through Jesus Christ our Lord. And after all, the other people who have different views, maybe we shouldn't necessarily disagree. After all, we wouldn't want anybody to dislike us, would we? And that's what this program is all about. They're playing psychological games with your mind. And you better understand what it's about. The video of Diaprax in the Church, the four-tape set, the Church Growth Movement. You need to get my video, The Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get Iraq, The Untold Story. You need to get Megiddo, The March to Armageddon. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.